Welcome to the 52nd episode of Reverse Row Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as England struggle to pick their squad for the Ashes, welcome to the podcast that's never had selection issues.
Yep, I'm afraid it's still Andy and I here, but at least we've got lots of new things to talk about. We're going to be reviewing what's been happening over the last couple of weeks. Andy's going to be taking us through the slightly murky history of that quirky dismissal handled the ball. We're going to be reviewing the excellent The Following Game from Jonathan Smith, and we've got an interview with the cricket journalist Jack Mendel. In amongst all of the sort of beginning of the Champions League and all of those kind of things, actually the real highlight of the last 2 weeks, I think, for both of us has happened in Test cricket, hasn't it?
And it's happened in Harare, which is not, in recent years, a place where you'd have expected a highlight in Test cricket. This is far more than your average underdog story. Zimbabwe are not just underdogs, but they've been hobbled by a truly useless administration, a complete lack of money, and the decisions by several of their top players to actually leave the country. I mean, Kyle Jarvis very recently has left, very talented team, has very recently gone to Lancashire, pretty much cut his links with Zimbabwe. I mean, this series between Zimbabwe and Pakistan almost didn't happen. Zimbabwean players, having not been paid for ages, had to be persuaded not to strike. They competed superbly in the first test, were only really outdone by a brilliant double ton by Yunus Khan. And you thought their chance had gone. You know, you thought you'd have Pakistan on the ropes. Pakistan won't let that happen again. And then Zimbabwe, in a brilliant second test, you know, back and forth, they secured a really memorable victory by 24 runs. I think the real story here was Zimbabwe's young bowling attack. The word that I kept hearing used, and in the small amount that I was able to watch, was discipline. For young bowlers who've had next to no experience of test level to bowl with such consistent discipline, really, it belied their total lack of experience.
That's the thing that is always lacking about the sort of minnow sides, isn't it? Because occasionally, you know, you get people who can score brilliant 50s, who can occasionally take 5 wicket hauls and things like that, but it's the discipline of being able to do that sort of over a long period of time consistently throughout a test match, which is always a challenge. And actually, that game was coming to a head at the same time as, I think it was the fourth one day between England and Australia. And I gave up following the England-Australia game. It was much more compelling. I mean, Pakistan did make a bit of a hash of it at the end.
They did. And there's obviously going to be a question as to, you know, to what extent did Pakistan mess this up and what extent Zimbabwe succeeded. But, you know, the young Zimbabwean bowlers, Tinashe Panyangara, great name, Tendai Chitara, Brian Vittori, for them to all be bowling with this well at this stage in their career bodes very well for the future. But I think perhaps the most pleasing thing about this whole series, as Brendan Taylor was very quick to point out, everyone contributed in small ways, from brilliant wicket keeping to like sort of nuggety little 50s there from different openers. It was a great all-round win.
So as we record here, up in North London, up at Lord's, is the final of their sort of one-day county season. It all closes today. And we're not the only people who aren't there, it seems. I was watching some of it this morning and it looks basically completely empty.
Just sad, isn't it?
Which is sad. But I'm actually quite happy that we're returning to 50-over cricket next summer for a couple of reasons, really. One of which is this ridiculous disconnect that we have at the moment between the international game and what's played throughout the world and what's happening in county cricket, and not just because counties should be, you know, a feeder for countries, basically, but also because just consolidating the types of cricket that are played at the highest level is, I think, quite important. But also there's something about 50-over cricket that I think is hugely engaging, and as much as anything, it's about those middle overs, and particularly now that the power plays and everything have come in and the fielding restrictions, what was in the past a bit of a slog to get through suddenly has become really engaging.
It's interesting because I think a lot of people would, I don't actually have a very strong view on this, but I think a lot of people would disagree on you. A lot of people feel that those middle overs are part of the problem. There is a sense, I've heard the argument made, that 40 overs have worked quite well for counties. They found it worked quite well in terms of attendance. So they find that certain people are happier to turn out on Sunday for a 40-over game because, you know, it starts that bit later.
I
haven't seen the stats backing that up necessarily, but that case has been made. Mm.
So those are the things that we've enjoyed and look forward to. What's been your low point?
Well, I was delighted to see Michael Carberry given his shots.
At long last.
He's a player who's come through a lot of hardship, come through serious illness to get back to the end, and also has been a top performer at county level for
a very
long
time. He's
just
been one of those people who England seem to have not wanted to have selected.
No, and actually when he, I mean, what, the couple of chances I've had to see him back this year, he's been impressive and spectacular. He's not just been sort of, you know, effective. He really has been a standout player. So I guess what's let me down is, firstly, I mean, disappointed that he hasn't really been able to take his chance fully. He made a useful, very useful and well-constructed half century in the one ODI England didn't win, but made little in the others.
Well, and also, I mean, there were these sort of horror games he had, you know, when he dropped whatever it was, dropped three two characters and was out for naughts or whatever it was in the...
And you're right, it was a horror game. That island game where I think he dropped three catches then went for a duck. I mean, the point is, though, what I think has really frustrated me about the whole thing is I've heard people saying, well, you know, he's clearly not international level, he's a county player. Why is it fine for us to write Michael Carberry off after four ODIs and give Johnny Bairstow, you know, his eighth or ninth test? You know, this is not a personal vendetta against Johnny Bairstow. It's more just this unfairness that we have touched before on the podcast, that certain players seem to be given all this time to prove themselves and others don't.
I mean, it's a classic, it's Nick Copton versus Joe Reed, isn't it?
Exactly. One is and one isn't. And I know age comes into it, and that obviously does make sense. But put your best 11 out, and I think it will be a real shame, as I now think is likely, that is Carberry's shot. And I think it'll be a real shame if it is.
Talking of putting your best 11 out, England, of course, played a little bit. Well, you can't really call it a B-side, but they certainly rested some key players for that Australia series. And I have to say, I kept on going through it. And it's something else that we talk about quite a lot. But it's something that crops up quite a lot in the international calendar. That it's quite difficult, apart from World Cups, which just drag on for months on end and no one really cares, it's quite difficult to find one-day series that have a huge amount of meaning nowadays. And actually, England versus Australia really, you know, it has everything going for it in terms of it's becoming a pinnacle of the game. And the reality is that, you know, some of the most memorable one-day series are, for instance, the one back in 2005. And, you know, we always talk about 2005 as a halcyon summer, but I'll carry on doing it. Where it happened beforehand. And it kind of had an existence in
you
its own right.
You almost
buy
into
here,
the pre-enthusiasm.
Exactly. Whereas here, it just has this feeling of being after the Lord Mayor's show, which I think does it a great disservice.
I think the big question to ask here, will anyone remember who won this series in 5 years' time? Will anyone remember who won it in a year's time?
The Australians will, I think. It's a popular pub quiz question. Name all of the ways of getting out in cricket. In this episode from the archives, Andy is going to take us through one of the rarest of those dismissals, handling the ball.
If ye striker touches or takes up ye ball before she is layin' quite still, unless asked by ye bowler or wicketkeeper, it's out. So says the original cricketing code of 1744, that first real attempt to actually formalise the rules of the game. 269 years on, the law hasn't really changed. So this is Law 33 of the MCC Laws of Cricket. Either batsman is out handled the ball if he willfully touches the ball while in play with a hand or hands not holding the bat unless he does so with the consent of a fielder. So with a fewer yees, it's pretty much the same law. And I think given all the tweaks that cricket's rules have undergone over time, it's actually quite interesting to note that this is one that's remained very, very constant. Basic idea being, don't touch the ball unless you've asked.
I suppose there are two things there, one of which is very simple and it's very clear, and the other of which is just that it doesn't really happen very often.
Yes, it's not one of those rules that we constantly need to revisit. It hasn't caused a huge amount of time. There's never really been, well, we'll come to it in a sec, there's never been huge scandal over it. There's been sort of mini scandals that we'll come to. There have been a couple of little changes, probably for the better. Prior to 1899, a batsman could be given out for handling the ball even if they were removing a ball which had got stuck in their equipment or clothing, which seems a tad unreasonable. What I love, though, as part of this, is that at that time, if a fielder removed the ball from a batsman's clothing, they could claim a catch. So it's a rather wonderful idea that if the ball just got lodged in your pads and I sprint in from slip and grab it.
But you can just imagine these wonderful comic scenes of kind of a batsman, ball stuck in their pads, kind of dancing
frantically
around,
shaking
trying to dislodge it while a fielder scampering in trying to get it out.
Actually, that would be fantastic at test level. That would make things far more entertaining. Also, probably again rather sensibly, in 1950, the law changed to allow players to protect themselves. So if you can imagine a scenario where handling the ball is vital to protect your safety, that's okay as well. The only real way to get to the heart of this dismissal is to talk about some of the key famous dismissals. Russell Endine, a South African batsman, in 1957 became the first international batsman to be given out handled the ball. Jim Laker bowled a ball which rose above his bat, was heading for the stumps before Endine struck it out the way. I like the fact that Endine had the nickname Endless Endine, which I think is a rather great nickname for a batsman, his determination to stay at the crease. He also, after this incident, said that he had considered heading it away, which I think would have been a fantastic sight.
In an era before helmets would have been a very interesting way to
do it. A brave move indeed. Andrew Hilditch, who we all know, as the Australian selector in 1979, managed a very impressive feat, became the first non-striking batsman to be dismissed handle the ball. Hilditch charitably picked up the ball after a wayward throw from a Pakistani fielder, but the bowler, Safraz Nawaz, appealed. A lot of the Pakistani players, as you can imagine, were pretty uncomfortable with an appeal that definitely was not within the spirit of the game. But it actually fitted in with what had been a very, very bad-tempered series. And I think this is a really good example, actually, of where if cricket's being played in the wrong spirit, as it was certainly in this series, these laws can be twisted.
And actually, for you know, for a batsman, it's something that's actually... I was going to say it's gentlemanly, but that's taking it a bit far. That, you know, if the ball rolls along to your feet and you're standing yards away from the stumps and nothing's really in play, to pick it up and chuck it to the bowler isn't really a thing, as it were. And I suppose that the law probably wasn't designed in any way to... kind of to cover that kind of incident.
No, and it was a good example of where by ignoring the spirit of the game, the law was really it acted in a way it certainly wasn't supposed to. Now to two greats of the game, Kapil Dev bowling to Desmond Haynes in a test in Mumbai. It's 1983. The ball deflected off Haynes's bat and pad, was heading towards the stumps, and Haynes brushed it away nonchalantly with his hand. What I love about this is Haynes then refused to leave the crease because he claimed he was unaware of the law, which is obviously a great excuse. The next time I'm LBW, I'll say I don't recognise that.
But the thing is that in that sense, it's not really just a sort of arbitrary law that you have to abide by. It's not like something, you know, if the ball pitches outside leg stump, you can't be out LBW. Mm. It's not something that's arbitrary like that. It's just pretty fundamental to the rules of cricket that someone bowls the ball and you hit it with the bat rather than sort of standing there and catching it. Otherwise, people could go out in wicketkeeper gloves if they wanted to be night watchmen.
Well, quite. And I think this incident gets more bizarre when the umpire asked Kapil Dev if he wished to rescind the appeal, which, given that Haynes had effectively prevented the ball hitting his stumps, I mean, that is the most blatant use of handling the ball, it seems rather charitable of the umpire. And I think
presumably if the umpire gives him out, then that should be the last.
And I think Dev quite rightly insisted that Haynes should be on his way. Now, the most recent, and I guess the only one of these dismissals that actually I had any recollection of, 2001 test against India, and Michael Vaughan is going well. He's made 50-60 odd by this stage, and he's now the most recent international batsman to be outhandled the ball. Went for a sweep, missed it, and with the ball trickling off his pad, he just instinctively kind of flicked it away. It's interesting, that reaction, that obviously that protective desire not to see your stumps hit by the ball. Now, everyone who watched it was very clear on the fact that the ball wasn't heading towards the stumps. It wasn't actually going to hit the stumps. And Nasser Hussain, after this dismissal, said that the Indian appeal was against the spirit of the game, which I think is very interesting because it suggested that this law has kind of evolved. And there's now an understanding that even though the law says nothing about it, you should really only appeal if the ball's going to hit the stumps. If it's not hitting the stumps, it's somehow acceptable. The law says nothing about it, but that almost seems to be an understanding that's crept in.
So one final thought on this. In 2005, Edgbaston, Michael Kasparich given out, caught behind by Geraint Jones. And a lot of people say it wasn't out because his hand wasn't on the bat. However, he could have been out-handled ball. He did touch the ball. His hand wasn't on the bat, and we've seen that that's a specific part of the law in the current MCC incarnation of it. It's your hand is off the bat, touches the ball, you can be out-handled ball.
To the book review, and this episode we're discussing The Following Game by Jonathan Smith. Jonathan Smith was a renowned English teacher at Tunbridge School, where he taught, amongst others, Vikram Seth. He's also written extensively on education, but also written several novels and screenplays as well. He's connected to cricket in a variety of ways. He taught several famous cricketers, including Chris Cowdery, has a personal lifelong love of the game, but perhaps his keenest and closest connection is the father of England cricketer Ed Smith.
The book begins on a slightly morbid note with his being diagnosed with cancer, and he's sort of hurried into writing the book that he says that he's wanted to write all his life, which is, as the title suggests, The Following Game. It's about him following cricket and the way that he's been connected to cricket. But in reality, the book's a lot more wide-ranging, and there are sort of three overlapping narratives that happen throughout it, one of which is a sort of autobiography about his own life as a cricket fan from being a child. The second is about Ed's career and being the father of a cricketer and how that develops. The third is that shortly after he's diagnosed with cancer, he and Ed go off to India for a journey across India, and so there's an element of travelogue about it. And then the fourth is that when they go to India, Ed says to him, bring along 10 of your favourite poems and let's talk about them. Obviously, he's been a teacher, and Ed wants to learn from his father, who, frankly, at this time, they don't know how much longer he's going to be alive for. So there are these four strands going on. Do you think the book becomes a bit of a mess because of it?
I've had this problem at work this week when people have seen this book on my table and asked me what it's about. And it's impossible to give a brief answer to that question. I do think it holds together. I think the book is a ramble, and I mean that in the best possible way, in the way that you very clearly described, it goes from his love of cricket to India to poetry to back to following Ed Smith's career, but it does so with a wonderful lightness of touch, and it does so in a way that shows more vitally how all these connect.
Mm. There's a wonderful... wonderful section in the book where he's talking about the poetry of Edward Thomas, and it seemed to me that it kind of summed up quite nicely his own writing, actually. And there are a couple of times throughout the book where he's talking about other people's writing, and it might as well talk about his own. And he says of a poem by Edward Thomas, "He has touched on all the big issues, the watermarks of experience, and yet there is no striving after any of them. He touches on life, death, nature, time, love, loss, the random nature of fate, our need for human connection." And actually, that's one of the wonderful things about this book, that it does manage to draw all of these things together in a way that's actually sort of simultaneously very human and very humble within, you know, from Jonathan Smith's perspective rather than from any kind of particularly esoteric perspective. And I think it comes across in another way as well, which is that, for instance, you know, as you said, he knows Vikram Seth, he knows Chris Cowdery, he goes and have tea with Don Bradman at some point like this. But at no point throughout the book do you get the sense of this man thinking of himself as a kind of celebrity. And he has the kind of wide-eyed wonder about all of this that, you know, one of us might have going to meet all these wonderful people.
And I think, especially with Ed Smith, there is no real... I've not read anything in cricket literature that looks at this issue of being the family member of a prominent cricketer. And I think that's obviously one of the fascinating niches of this book. And, I mean, these struggles that he goes through following it are very vivid. And it also makes you aware of the fact that a successful career at the high end of anything, whether it's sport or something else, it drags so many other people with you.
There's a brilliant description of Trent Bridge on Ed's test debut against the South Africans. And there's this wonderful two or three pages that describes the kind of half a day that they have to sit there before he comes out to bat, where he's kind of, he's very superstitious in there, sitting there trying to sort of decide, you know, should he sip his water only between overs or between balls or while the bowler's running up and this kind of thing.
The superstition thing is brilliant. There's one where he's on Ed Smith. They've been following the game on CFAX because they can't watch it, and Ed Smith's made 90-odd in a county game. And the wife says, "Can we turn on the radio?" And he's like, "No,
no,
please,
it would curse it.
The radio goes on, and the first thing they hear is that Smith's out for 99. It's more, though, it's not just about the experience of following a famous and successful side. It's about how you follow correctly. And it kind of comes down to this sort of Agassi conundrum, which Smith refers to, that Andre Agassi had this brutal childhood, which Smith describes well. You know, tennis was not in any way a game, a thing to be enjoyed. It was an occupation of, like, military precision and military discipline. And Agassi succeeded, but hated cricket, hated tennis for it, for the way he had come to it. And Jonathan Smith does touch with this difficult thing. You know, you as a father want the best for your children, but how, and you want them to succeed, but how do you do that without actually harming them? You know, he accepts the fact that whether he thinks he did or not, in ways he was, you know, the pushy parent, I guess is the phrase we use for it. And, you know, you play that big role in your child's life without almost ever, you know, giving the child that decision.
We came across this book because a friend of mine, I'd never heard of it before, actually. I don't know if you have.
I hadn't.
A friend of mine just sent it to me in the post and for my birthday a couple of months ago. And she just said, "I don't really know what it's about. It's got a picture of some cricket pads on the front, so you might like it, but, you know, maybe give it a try." And actually, that sums it up quite well. As you say, you don't really know what it's about, and it's a very, very hard act to pull off a book that's not about something very specifically. But, I mean, if any book has done it, I think it's this one. For this episode's interview, I spoke to Jack Mendel, whose writing on cricket is published by Sideline Agenda and Crick Info. But on top of all of that, he's also doing a degree in politics, and I began by asking him whether life as a cricket journalist and university student were compatible.
You know how it's very easy to get distracted from work? Yeah, I certainly do.
Well, cricket writing is just another way of doing that, basically. So, it's, you know, I could write for my dissertation, or I could write my top five cricketing injuries.
Brilliant. It's a very productive distraction. Talking of distractions, county season drawing to a close. You watch quite a lot of county cricket, I think. What have been... Tell me about a few moments that you think have been significant over the summer or that you've particularly enjoyed.
As a Middlesex fan, there haven't been that many to enjoy. I've enjoyed seeing Surrey being bottom. I've quite enjoyed seeing Durham prove a lot of people wrong. Mm. A lot of people had them down as relegation candidates, and they've really been very, very strong, especially bowling. With guys like Stokes and Borthwick, they've completely turned the championship on its head. Mm. And in the second division, I think it's really good that Lancashire have come straight back up. And hopefully next year we'll see Lancashire-Yorkshire, which is always a very good contest to see.
The Durham thing's interesting, isn't it? Because particularly when you contrast it with Surrey, who you were talking about earlier, because Durham have always kind of relied on a lot of homegrown players, whereas Surrey have sort of become the, you know, the Manchester City of the cricket world, and they've brought in a lot of players from outside, but it hasn't really done them good, has it?
Surrey have, but they've also had a lot of really bad luck. Kind of at the beginning of the season, there was this big hype that at some point they'd get Ponting, Smith and Peterson all in the same 11 together, and it turned out that Ponting only was there for a little bit. Smith got injured. Now they've got Amla.
Mm.
You know, it hasn't really panned out for them, and they've had Dernbach and Tremlett both on and off with England as well. So, you know, they've had a lot of trouble, but it doesn't help also that they're building their team pretty much on 38-year-olds.
Yeah.
It's just not sustainable.
Yeah, completely. Talking of international stars, the Champions League is about to start again, that time of year again. And of course, none of the England teams are going to be playing out there. Do you think that's a significant step for it?
I think it is a bit of board politics, really. I think it's significant because, I mean, they could have just delayed it by a week, and then English clubs would have been allowed into it.
Yeah, it's very marginal. You would have thought that they could have put their heads together and actually worked out a way to shift it around.
But, I mean, the whole thing is run by the BCCI, Cricket Australia and Cricket South Africa. But the fact that BCCI can put so many teams into it, whereas, you know, the West Indies only get one team, New Zealand only get one team, even just in the qualifying bit, it's very kind of geared to what they want.
Mm.
And if the boards don't have enough power, if the ECB doesn't have enough power to say, you know, we want this to move, then quite honestly, I completely agree with them for saying, We're not gonna enter them, because, you know, why should they be bossed around? Mm. Why should they be dictated to?
There's a Bangladesh team, isn't there, that sort of has qualified, as it were, but isn't going to be able to play. And it's interesting, exactly as you say, that, you know, it's turned into what's supposed to be quite a kind of democratic format, taking club teams from all over the world, has turned into the BCCI kind of bossing it once again. But do you think? I mean, you know, the name, the Champions League, it's quite clearly set up to be a replication of football's Champions League, which is sort of known as the number one tournament that everyone watches. You know, it's the sort of number two to the World Cup, if you see what I mean. Do you think that's kind of the way forward for sort of club county cricket, having that kind of international structure to it?
No, not really, quite honestly. I think, especially in the UK, we have a very established county system. People like the county system. Everyone has their own county, and I don't think there are too many people disappointed that, you know, that their county isn't in the Champions League. Mm. I'm sure the counties themselves aren't very happy. I mean, the winner gets 2.5 million, the runner-up gets over 1 million, loser, the semi-finals get 500,000. You know, this is a lot of money for county sides. Mm. But I don't think the fans really care, to be honest. I don't think it's a big thing in you know, maintaining support. I think the biggest problem is going to be, I mean, there was a story that broke today that Hales wants to go to the IPL, but Nottinghamshire have said no players are going to the IPL because it clashes with the English season. I think the only way that it's ever going to be compatible, the English county season, with these, you know, franchises, is if it isn't always in India.
So do you generally think it's a good thing that the English counties are kind of standing up for themselves?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think that a lot of these boards think that they can just pop up these 2020 leagues all over the world and get this, you know, quick buck. But actually, I think people still like the, you know, the established cricket. Mm. People like to see the teams that they've always supported, they grew up supporting.
So will you be watching the Champions League?
I don't even know if it's on TV. Is it? I don't think so.
To be completely honest, until you said, until we were talking about what we might discuss on this interview, and you said the Champions League is coming up, to be honest, I didn't actually know that it was coming up. So, it does sort of slip under the radar a bit. And part of it is because it's not part of... It just hasn't become part of the sort of rhythm of the cricketing calendar.
Yeah.
In the way that, as you say, county cricket is, which is why we all follow county cricket. So, so it's not going to be on the TV. I didn't know it was going to happen, but give me a prediction.
Well, before I say who's going to win it, it's a bit of an odd kind of setup because they have a qualifying stage and then a main stage. So the qualifying stage, they've got team from Pakistan, team from New Zealand, team from Sri Lanka, and an IPL team. Who else? I think that the Pakistani team and the New Zealand side will go through. And then I don't think you can look past this. You can't really look past Chennai to win the overall thing. They've just got such a good team. Just in every department. I don't see who can get past them.
This issue about the Champions League and kind of the desirability of it, I think that's where the BCCI are kind of going to come a cropper, because they kind of assume that their product is the only one that the world wants to see, really.
Yeah, but and also the big issue with that is that they've got the biggest market. You know, they've got a billion people in India, and a lot of them watch cricket.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can put these big leagues on and boss people around because they put so much money into it. And as you saw with South Africa, if somebody upsets them, then they can pile on financial pressure by simply just pulling out of a tour. All the TV rights that go with that, that covers a lot of people's wages, you know, a lot of players' wages. So it is important. They do have a lot of power.
Exactly, as you say, there have been these times where the BCCI have pulled the India team out of tours for very self-interested reasons. Do you think there's ever going to come a time when the ICC are able to sit them down and say, you can't do that, you've got to play in the interests of everyone?
Well, not really, because... There isn't really an ICC. I mean, there is an ICC. Physically, there is an ICC. But all the fixtures are made by the boards.
Mm.
I mean, they basically collude to make tours.
Yeah.
Think of the number of times England play Australia, India play Australia, India play England, South Africa play England and India and Australia. Mm. There's kind of a top four that just play each other at least every 2 years.
Which if you're someone like Ireland, is, you know, basically the whole problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the same as Zimbabwe. Who wants to go and tour Zimbabwe
for
more than two tests?
To the debate. In this episode, we're asking whether comparing cricketers from different eras is ultimately fun but futile.
I think statistics are where cricket fans instantly go for comparison, and generally that makes a lot of sense. But I do think in between different eras, statistics can lie even more than they usually do. One line that I've heard trotted out by a lot of journalists and commentators that I actually believe, that an average of 40 for a batsman in the 90s is about equivalent now to a batsman in the noughties who averages 50. The bowlers were very, very special in the 90s, and batting conditions were worse. And I mean, that's just a particular example of where a pure average comparison of batsmen between eras won't get you
there. But there's another thing now, which is that the assumption that an average tells you everything about a batsman rather than where those runs are scored or anything else. Sure. And in fact, you know, we have enough difficulty comparing cricketers of the same era than comparing, you know, this whole who's better, Ponting, Tendulkar, Lara debate. Mm. You know, they're all playing in the same pitches and vaguely against the same attacks, but we still have enough difficulty between them.
I think there are, however, lots of areas where you can make really useful and really interesting comparisons. I think one of those is that cricket is a very aesthetic game, and we fall in love with batsmen and bowlers because of the way they look. So, you know, I cannot get over how many people go on about David Gower's bloody cover drives. You know, I think it's an obsession with people who are around at that time.
But even then, it's quite difficult to make the comparison simply because we don't know. And that actually, I mean, I have this thing that when I watch, there are a few clips of Don Bradman watching. When I watch him, I think, you know, he must have been really, really good because actually trying to watch the ball when everything was in black and white must have been a real thing. But you know what I mean in that regard. And actually, you only have certain evidence, so you know, you might read Neville Cardness on the cover.
I'm fairly sure that Don Bradman can see in colour. It's just a guess.
No,
I do know what you're getting at, but I think aesthetic comparisons are in a way quite easy
and
to
it's,
make.
And it's also about, I think, the way that teams play. In the sense that we know quite a lot about, for instance, what Len Hutton did with the England side in the 1950s, which was basically try and bat themselves into a position where they couldn't lose. Mm. And, you know, they would go out and they would quite happily bat for 3 days of a test and score 400 at a run rate of 0.8 or something like that. And actually, in having that context, it allows you to look at what's going on now and look at the way that teams are playing. And as you say, it is an aesthetic thing in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good point that you can't compare individual players without the context of the team. I mean, anyone who's listened to this podcast for more than a very short time would know that I have a major man crush on Shiv Chandrapur. And you can't understand Shiv Chandrapur without being aware that he's played in a desperately poor West Indies team. Mm-hmm. That is who makes Shiv Chandrapur who it is. And to compare him as an individual, watching him bat with, you know, for example, I mean, you know, for even for Lara, frankly, who got out of things just before things got really terrible for the West Indies, it makes it difficult.
I think this is the thing, that actually when you're comparing cricketers at all, let alone across different eras, but actually perhaps particularly when you're comparing them across different eras, I think you have to be aware of what you're trying to achieve. Because if you're trying to achieve an idea of who's best, I think that ultimately is going to be futile, because that is just down to opinion as much as anything else. But when you're picking out certain things about cricketers, actually being able to have this context and being able to see what other people did at different times is the important thing.
I think you're right, and I think what you can do, rather than comparing what's best, is you can actually build up a sense of just different themes and ideas of batting and different themes and ideas of bowling. And I mean, I'll give you an example. I think you can compare cricketers in terms of personality. Now, I am a big, big Kevin Peterson fan, and the thing I've always enjoyed about Kevin Peterson, ever since he came to the England scene, is that swagger. That way he goes out to the crease with an arrogance that he's like, I'm going to get on top of this bowling attack right from the start. You know, even if that means dancing down to Nathan Lyon and nearly getting out first ball, I'm going to do that. And I think of it a lot when I look at old footage of Viv Richards. It's that same swagger. And making those comparisons, you see that actually, I'm not asking who's better, KP or Viv Richards. I'm more just saying how wonderful that is, how wonderful that cricketing arrogance is.
Thanks for listening to the 52nd episode of Reverse Web Radio. The nights are drawing in and autumn's coming on apace, but don't worry, we'll be with you throughout the winter.